Okay, this is John Sharkey speaking with Dr. Foyle Miller at his home in Glenview, Illinois. I know that you were born on January 18th, 1916 in Aurora, Illinois. Can you tell me a little bit about your parents?
My father was Canadian. He lost his mother when he was about 10 or 15 and was raised by his father. And they were rather poor economic circumstances. I know for two winters he worked in what they called a shanty, which was a logging camp. One of them was up on the Wanapitei River. I don't recall the location of the other one. But anyway, his job, he was fourth cook, which meant essentially he peeled the potatoes. Pretty tough for a young boy to be sent up there in the woods for the winter time.
Yeah.
Then he started to work at a local general store, and he expanded his ambitions and moved across Lake Ontario to Rochester, worked there, and then he moved to Dayton. He was very footloose. I remember that he was telling that he was at a party some young people were having in Dayton, and a girl visited from Minneapolis, and she had a book of pictures of the city of Minneapolis, and he thought, oh, that looks like a nice place, I think I'll go there. So he just moved there and took a job. And then he went from there to a smaller city in Minnesota called Winona, where he was the chief buyer of fabrics, bulk goods, for a department store. And that's where he met my mother. Now, my mother came from Pennsylvania Dutch ancestry. Her grandparents had emigrated from central Pennsylvania to Pepin, Wisconsin, a little village on the Mississippi River. That was a pretty interesting experience. This was 1858, and the family and several other families from the same village, Somerville in Jefferson County, Pennsylvania, they decided to go. So they appointed three young men to go out and make land claims. And they did. They went to the land office in Hudson, Wisconsin, and made their claims. But during the winter, the family got rid of everything it didn't want to take, and they put their goods on a raft and floated them down Red Bank Creek to the Allegheny River, and then down the Allegheny to Pittsburgh. There were several children. They left one daughter back there because she had been married, but everybody else came. In Pittsburgh, they got on a new boat that had just been built called the Canada. It was the maiden voyage of the Canada, and it was going to St. Paul. It went from Pittsburgh down the Ohio River to the Mississippi, then up the Mississippi. And it was interesting. I know they had some fowl with them, geese or chickens or something, and the mother gave birth to a baby en route. I've always been astounded. This family set off knowing that she was pregnant, and she gave birth en route.
Wow.
To my Uncle Milt, whom I knew very well. He lived in the same village with us. Anyway, they got off the boat on the banks of the Mississippi and ultimately claimed their land and built a house and lived there. I've never asked my grandfather where they stayed when they arrived. I've often wished I had. I just don't know where they lived for the months it took to build a house. Mm. Also, they took a farm on what is now regarded as very poor soil. It was an old sandbar under the Mississippi River. And had they gone back in one of the valleys, the soil would be rich and fine and no rocks. Here it was sandy and dried out quickly and didn't have much nutrient. Mm. My father asked my grandfather why they settled there, and he said it was because of water. There were no pumps, no hand pumps in those days, and there was a spring on the property, and that made it attractive to them.
Now, this was in Pepin, Wisconsin?
This was in Pepin, yeah.
Pepin. Yeah. And were your sisters, you had five sisters?
I had five sisters.
And were they born in Pepin, Wisconsin?
Yes, all of them. Well, one was in a hospital. There's only one born in the hospital.
Is that right?
That was in Winona.
And it's amazing, you said a little earlier today that all but one are still alive.
And that's right.
In their 80s and 90s. Wow, it's good bloodlines there.
Yep. One had diabetes, and that's what finished her. My mother remembers Indians coming to the door trying to trade a squash for a loaf of fresh bread. She was raised in Pepin. She went to business school and wound up ultimately working in Winona. She was the chief secretary of J.R. Watkins of the Watkins Company, quite a well-known company there. And she met my father in Winona and they got married. Mm-hmm. So that's the family background. Wow. Now his work was as a traveling salesman selling sheet metal ware, tubs and pails and boilers and setter cans and things like that, primarily used by the dairy industry. And so he traveled initially by railroad, and that's why they moved to Aurora, where I was born, because it was a railroad junction.
Mm-hmm.
Then my mother's mother died in Pepin and left her father and a sickly sister. So my family moved back to Pepin to take care of them. They had a large house there. And Dad said he could travel out of Pepin all right, because the Burlington ran through there.
Mm.
After some years, then he drove instead of taking the train. And of course, it didn't make any difference at that stage.
Now, in your high school, there were only seven students in your graduating
class? Seven in the graduating class. There were more than that, but the numbers figured off.
Right.
They stayed to work the family farm. That was the thing. This was also in the Depression.
Yes.
And I graduated in 33, and that hit people pretty hard.
Sure.
So the numbers in the class just kept dwindling, and there were only seven.
Yeah.
I think I'm the last one living, far as I know.
Were there any teachers that had an influence on you in your high school?
Yes, I was very fortunate in a teacher of grammar and English. She taught to us with the notes she had from her college course. And she was a disciplinarian and drilled us. I could parse sentences to a fairly well. And I've always been so grateful for having had her. I wanted to write her a thank you letter, but unfortunately she died in childbirth just a few years after I graduated.
Oh.
And I never did that, to my great regret.
What attracted you to chemistry?
Accident. We didn't have any chemistry in our high school at all, but we had general science, and the general science paper came in the homeroom one day, came to me with a book, and he said, "Here, Foyle, would you like to have this?" It was a high school text on chemistry that some publishing house had sent him, and he wasn't teaching it, so he gave it to me. Now I should back up. Before, we had in our home a encyclopedia called the Book of Knowledge, 20 volumes. And I read through that. I think I got through volume 19.
Wow.
And there would be a section on literature, stories, you know, and then games, and then on mathematics, and then geography and science and so on. And I got to the chemistry part, and I thought it was so dull, all that H2O stuff and CO2. And I thought it was terribly dull. But several years later, when the teacher gave me that book, I looked through it and I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was very good. So I decided to be a chemist on that ground.
Wow.
And I have always thought I was cut out to be a chemist, because not only was that a handicap, but the chemistry staff where I went to college was very poor. And in spite of that, I still went on to graduate school.
And that was at Hamline University.
That was at Hamline, yeah.
Hamline. I had never heard of that. I had to look it up, and it's a very highly rated university. It's tops in
the...
It's
the first school in Minnesota, first school, yes.
Right. So you were very fortunate to go there, especially during the Depression.
I certainly was. They made a real effort to help people stay in school. I got a summer job there. During the year, I had work. I opened and closed the buildings. I opened them in the morning and closed them up at night, and swept the steps and that sort of thing. So college was a great experience for me. It was like opening whole new worlds. Here I came from a little country boy from a small school. Yeah. And I was exposed to things that I'd never been exposed to before. It was a great experience.
And you had some chemistry there as well.
I was a chemistry major.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay. Any particular teachers you remember there?
I remember them for being so poor.
Is that right?
And I realized at the time that they were poor.
Wow.
But in spite of that, I stayed with it.
And then you moved on to...
Well, let me give you an example of why they were poor. There were just two chemistry teachers, and the lower one was a lady who taught me physical chemistry, but she had never had calculus. And I had had calculus, so I knew more about the subject than she did. I could understand more on derivations and that sort of thing.
Right. And then I think you went to Nebraska for a while, and then to Johns Hopkins.
Yes, that was interesting. I applied for a teaching assistant at about eight different colleges. And in those days, they sent out the letters of acceptance around, let's see, April 1. I don't remember exactly,
right.
But there was a fixed date. So you would have them all in your hand at once. Well, Nebraska jumped the gun. They sent me a thing much earlier, about 6 weeks earlier, with an offer and with a statement that would I please respond right away. So I took it to my favorite physics professor and I asked him what to do. And he said, "Foyle, these are tough times." He said, "A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. If I turn it down, I may not get another offer." So he suggested I take it. So I did. But I didn't tell the other schools because I wanted to see what would happen.
Sure.
And it turned out I got four or five other offers too. But anyway, I went to Nebraska, and I'm very glad I did, because they were good in organic chemistry, and I got an excellent background in that. And I was never afraid to synthesize things from my experience there, which gave me a nice niche in my field of spectroscopy, because mm-hmm. we made things other people wouldn't touch and studied them, and there's some of these molecules very interesting. So I spent a year there, but incidentally, in that year, I've forgotten what I was paid now, but I paid round-trip train fare for two trips, down in fall, back at Christmas, and back in spring.
Mm-hmm.
I paid my room and board. I bought a suit, and I had $50 left over.
Wow.
I think I got $600 for the year. And but after a year, I decided that I wanted to go into physical chemistry, and they were not very good. And I had a friend who was graduating from Hopkins and was vacating a fellowship. So I thought, I'll apply for that fellowship and see if I can get it. And I did.
Right.
It paid $1,000 a year, which was big money. What I didn't know was that I had to pay tuition out of it.
Oh.
So I didn't wind up as far ahead as I thought.
And you became Professor Richard Lord's first graduate student.
Yes.
How did, was he new at the school?
He was new. He had just come back from being a postdoc in Copenhagen.
Okay.
And he arrived in the fall, and during that year was when we selected our research director.
Now, his work was, he did a lot of work during the war, and it was concerned with some, the early efforts on guided missiles.
Yes.
As well as military applications of infrared radiation.
Right.
Were you involved in that at all?
No, not at all. Let me think what happened. I got my degree in 42, and I stayed on and helped teach a course in analyzing explosives at Hopkins. Aberdeen Proving Ground was near Baltimore, and so a lot of people that were working over there came over and took this course. Then I went to Minnesota for 2 years, and then to Illinois, so I was there during the war.
Right, okay.
I did some work on the Rubber Reserve Project when I was at Illinois. I taught some of the naval people, I've forgotten what the acronym was, but they were naval people that were going to go into technical work.
Right.
So I taught them physical chemistry.
Okay. So at Hopkins, is that where you got introduced to infrared and Raman spectroscopy?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it was primarily Raman when I started. Infrared was very uncommon. And so Dick Lord built a Raman instrument. I helped him on that. And I was the one that did all the testing and lining and so on it. And then I also had the problem of making the deuterol pyroles, that is, pyrole with deuterium in it in various ways. Deuterium on the nitrogen, deuterium just on the carbons, deuterium in all positions, and getting the Raman spectra. At the end of my term, about 1940, it was 41, I think, in the spring, cyanamide had built an instrument at their labs, and Dick went down to consult with them or to visit them, and he took my samples with them and they ran them, and that was my first exposure to infrared.
Okay.
So I didn't actually do the experimental work on the infrared, but I had the spectra.
So in the early 1940s, there were no commercial IR or Raman instruments?
Hilger made a little tiny, almost useless one. It had started 20 years or so earlier. But that was the only thing on the market. There was nothing else. Every installation was homemade. There were perhaps a dozen or 15 of them around the world, mostly built by physicists, mostly used for high-resolution spectra of small gaseous molecules like ammonia and CO2 and so on.
Were there any instruments, the early IR and Raman instruments, that you consider to be landmark instruments?
Oh, yes. Both the first models of both the Beckman and the Perkin-Elmer instruments are such.
Okay. How important to your career and intellectual approach towards chemistry were your professors in college and graduate school?
Not so much in college, but certainly in graduate school. Mm. Yeah, I had some good, very good teachers. I took a course from Joe Mayer. Does that ring a bell?
No.
His wife is Maria Gebhard Mayer, who got the Nobel Prize in physics.
Yeah, sure.
He was a very capable chap. Mm. Oh yeah, they had a big influence. A man named Fred Weisselogel had a big influence in setting a teaching example. My teaching style is modeled very much after the one he used. Mm.
It seems when I was reading over your background, you were very fortunate to, number one, meet Professor Lord, who you remained friendly with for many years, and number two, that you were just getting into a field, infrared and Raman, that was just starting.
Exactly. I was extremely fortunate in my timing.
Your timing was just perfect.
Yeah, it certainly was. I have often said I had a wonderful career, which would be very hard to equal, I think. And coming back to Dick Lord, he was a very good mentor, and we were warm personal friends up till he died. Yes. And I continued contact with his wife, and she died just a few months ago.
Oh, wow. And then, great. You then moved on to the University of Minnesota as a National Research Council postdoctoral fellow with Bryce Crawford. Did you continue your work in spectroscopy there?
Oh, yes. Yes. Bryce was building an infrared instrument, and he had a Raman instrument. He had a spectrograph that had been acquired by his predecessor, George Klotler. It was a three-prism Steinheil spectrograph, just marvelous mechanical things. Lots of flexibility. You could change the telescope, and you could change the number of prisms you used, and so on. But he had a student who was building an infrared instrument, and I worked with him a great deal. And then I did a theoretical job on the vibrations of benzene with Bryce, the normal coordinate treatment of it. It was my first exposure to normal coordinates, and about my last. I was very glad to have a sampling of it, and I decided it was a losing proposition. There were many, many papers published on the subject, but that was the only one by me.
Oh, okay. Minnesota was known for mass spectrometry. There was Alfred Neer.
Alfred Neer, yeah.
Did you have any contact with his research group? Or
I knew Al, but I didn't have any real working contact with him. In fact, he was away most of the time at, I believe, Oak Ridge, setting up the big mass spec facility. Was it K-12 or... Anyway, there was a huge collection of they called the mass spectrometers calutrons from California. And the way I got to know him, I guess, if I remember rightly, was through the faculty club. I used to have lunch at the faculty club. Bryce Crawford was very good about taking me over and introducing me and getting me in. So that was really my only contact with Al.
Now, did he build his own instruments as well, or were
yes, yeah.
He wasn't just using a commercial.
There were no commercial instruments.
No commercial mass spectrometer.
No, not at all.
Wow, amazing. Well, I assume by this time you had decided to spend your professional career as a spectroscopist.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
And I never thought of not doing it until pretty late in my career. I thought at that stage that maybe I ought to change. And I had a sabbatical, which I spent at the University of Arizona, looking into solar energy and seeing what the prospects were. I didn't go, I stayed in spectroscopy. I decided solar energy was awaiting some breakthrough discovery, which would probably come unexpectedly, not by somebody working on that problem, but by somebody else. It'd be an accident in effect, and serendipitous perhaps, and I didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And spectroscopy, on several occasions I had thought the field was getting ripe, and every time some new thing would turn up which would revitalize it. Initially it was the introduction of chopped optical systems, yes, to avoid drift, thermal drift of the room and surroundings. Then there was there were sample handling methods, the KBR press disk method, and the the idea of freezing samples in a very dilute argon matrix, for example. Several more sampling problems like that. Mm-hmm. Then in came the Fourier transform, which just revolutionized the whole field. Mm-hmm. And in Raman spectroscopy, the advent of lasers, and then the very fast array detectors we get. Mm-hmm. Well, before that, photoelectric detection mm-hmm. replaced photographic detection. So periodically there were these revolutionary changes, and they just kept me in the field.
Right. Those early instruments were single beam instruments.
Exactly.
How did they, who came up with the idea? Was it Perkin-Elmer? Of
the Perkin-Elmer Model 21 was the first successful double beam instrument.
Okay.
No, that's not true. Baird built the first one. That was based on the instrument that Norman Wright and his colleagues built at Dow Chemical. And we had serial number one of the Baird at Mellon. It was marvelous. I couldn't get over how lucky I was that we could get a spectrum that was all plotted out, linear in microns,
right,
and percent transmission. It was a tremendous step forward. Perkin-Elmer came out with their 21 a few years later, and then that became a very successful instrument.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I remember using the Infracord.
That's right.
Where you had to change the paper halfway through, and change the grading, and it's But it
that was
got beautiful spectra. Beautiful spectra.
Beckman's entry.
Were you married by this time to Naomi?
Yes, we got married just after I'd finished my research, but before I was handed the degree.
Okay.
We got married in the fall of 41.
Wow.
And actually, I never attended a graduation ceremony where they awarded PhD degrees until many, many years later. My degree was handed to me through the grill of the registrar's office.
Sure, yeah.
Because I missed the spring graduation, had finished up in the fall, had my final oral in October, I think it was.
Wow. I'm going to stop this for a minute if I can figure out.